Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. As you know, there is a shortage of blood donation, and the reason for it, well, there's a couple, but the big one is that my generation, the baby boom, was taught about giving blood, and you do it on a regular basis. The generation behind us, though, didn't get into that habit, and so BloodWorks Northwest has been working on some way to fix that, and that's where Bill Harper comes in. Bill, you're an app developer from Degree 37. What's that?
Degree 37 is a technology company that was created here in Seattle specifically for this purpose, to help BloodWorks Northwest develop an app and be able to reach the millennial generation, mm-hmm. and create a whole new generation of givers.
Are you a millennial?
I am a millennial. I'm 29 years old.
And you're the perfect person to do this. So what is it that prevents millennials from giving blood on a regular basis?
What prevents them is basically millennials don't necessarily know how to donate blood. They don't know where to donate blood. And also, the reason for donating blood was never exactly explained to them necessarily in the way that it was to the baby boomer generation.
I'm trying to think, how was it explained to me? Just that it was, that people needed it for surgery, and it was a community-minded thing to do.
Exactly. It was more of a collective effort in generations past. And in the millennial generation, we are very connected by social media and other media, but the problem that faces blood banks today is that the way to donate blood and the places to donate blood are not necessarily, and the need, are not communicated on social media today. Mm-hmm. And this app should fix that problem.
So tell me how the app works.
So the app is available for both iOS and Android platforms. The app will show you in the palm of your hand locations of blood drives and blood centers near where you are. So it's location-based. And you'll be able to not only find the blood center or blood drive, but to be able to schedule a donation appointment at that exact time. And you will be able to learn about also the latest perks and promotions and read about donor and patient stories that are just more impetus for people to donate blood.
You have a pretty compelling story yourself. I'm not surprised you'd work on this because you've had how many transfusions?
I had 267.
Because of leukemia.
Leukemia, 33 surgeries, and a lot of bad luck.
Yeah. So, I mean, without blood donations, someone like you doesn't survive.
That's exactly right, Dave.
All right. So is any of this, though, just a fear of having a needle stuck into you and blood drained out of your body?
There's certainly an element of that. And even as someone who's had as much blood work and needle stabs and bone marrow biopsies as I have, I totally understand a fear of needles because it's an unnatural thing. However, if millennials start to begin to understand that the reason for donating blood, that it helps people just like them, just like people they care about, their brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, grandparents, then that fear can be overcome.
Yeah. Has this app been tried anywhere before?
It has. We did a pilot or a soft launch actually in Eugene just earlier in September, September 15th, and that went really well. There was a huge response at the University of Oregon, lots of new donors.
Really?
Yeah, and that's exactly our target market, and people coming into the Lane BloodWorks down there just having scheduled their donations on the app, and it's been a really big, already we're seeing a lot of participation.
Okay, so this is measurable. I mean, you actually saw more pints of blood donated because of the app. Huh?
Yeah, you're downloading the app and registering and scheduling that way.
Yeah.
And so because
what I'm saying is, it's one thing to download and register, but then at some point you got to go in and get yourself poked. So
yeah,
the people actually showed up then.
Yep.
Excellent. There's also a social media aspect to this. So you can, for example, share that you gave blood?
That's exactly right. It's totally linked to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all the social media accounts that young people and even older people use. And you can share that you donated blood with your friends. You can share that you're going, you know, ahead of time to a blood bank.
And it keeps score?
It keeps, absolutely, yeah. So you're when you download and register with the app, it will bring in your blood donation history if you've donated blood before. Mm-hmm. So that will all come in. So not only does it have the number of pints of blood that you've donated, it also will show you the number of lives you've impacted.
Yeah.
And that's a really compelling thing for people, to convince people to just become regular donors, that they get to see right there the number of lives that they've helped save.
I know they used to give out the pins for like 1 gallon and 5 gallons. Do you still give out the pins?
They still do. Yeah.
But exactly. Now you can share them on social media.
That's exactly right.
Brag about it. Do people, I mean, one of the motivations for my generation is that we get a free cookie at the end. And in this age where you're not supposed to touch sweets, you know, having somebody official, having a doctor, having a nurse hand you a sweet sort of says, it's okay this time.
We also offer chips.
You've got chips now, too?
We got all kinds of chips.
If I had any suggestion for the app, it's that you would also point out there what the reward is after you get
it. We do. So that's another element of the app just right there on the homepage. It points out the perks and promotions. The Bold for Blood campaign was just a campaign. So oftentimes we'll have, you know, raffles for Seahawks tickets. We have a partnership with iFly, the indoor skydiving company. And, yeah, we have lots of ongoing promotions all the time. So having the app on your phone, you'll be able to see.
So you get more than a cookie now.
Yeah.
You can get an experience of some kind.
Exactly. Yeah, we're trying to partner with as many local organizations as we can, just to kind of sweeten the deal. In addition to, of course, you know, saving up to 3 people's lives.
Yeah. And you should give us the pitch on that. I mean, when you donate blood, how is it used?
So it just depends. So your blood, it can be, depending on how they break it up in the lab, it can be separated into plasma, whole blood, platelets. And so depending on how that goes, you can literally help save up to 3 people's lives.
So again, how do you get the app? It's just on the iPhone App Store?
Yeah, the Apple App Store and on the Google Play, the Android App Store, the BloodWorks Donor app.
BloodWorks Donor app. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. All right. Bill Harper from Degree 37, which has developed the new BloodWorks Northwest app. A very good, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Donate blood, save a life, and get some chips. The city of Seattle is pulling the plug on its only low-barrier tiny house village next year. Low-barrier is code for we let you use drugs and alcohol when you live there. But Share Wheel, the activist group that manages the Licton Springs Village, says it is pulling out next week because of what it calls a toxic power dynamic, which also sounds like code for something. So that's why we have Hannah Scott here to explain it to us. Hannah.
Dave, last month the city announced that it was closing Licton Springs next March when its permit expires and shifting management from just homeless activist group Share Wheel to the Low Income Housing Institute, or LIHI, which was to take the lead and still work with Share Wheel for the remaining 5 months that the village was going to be open. But over the weekend, Share Wheel sent a letter to the city and LIHI saying it was pulling out early, citing what it described as a toxic power dynamic that was harmful to both the villagers and Share staffers. Charles Johnson is with Share and a staffer at the village.
And it seems abrupt, but this has been coming for quite a while. Based on the behavior of our partners. The conditions now under which we would have to work are untenable. How healthy would it be for the residents if there's a tension and conflict on the ground between us and LIHI's? You know, we have very different decision-making processes and views of how human beings should be treated.
In deciding to close the village, the city said not enough people were being moved out of the village into permanent housing, and too many of them were staying at the village for over a year. Johnson disagrees with that assessment, and he says that they've moved more people into housing than many of the other programs that work with the navigation team. As for the time the villages are staying there,
by all measures internally, you know, the residents are, they're stable. They don't want to move out onto the street again. They will accept housing as it becomes available or as it's appropriate. Some of them are seriously, seriously mentally ill. You know, you can barely get them to talk except if you put in a lot of time and get them to trust someone. You know, some of them just aren't housing ready until they've been in a place like this for a while.
On top of that, he says the city and LIHI never followed through on funding and case management that was expected from the start.
We never went at this as a blame game. Now we're reacting to being scapegoated, having somebody shame the villagers and the staff, you know, because of a lack of housing exits, which, by the way, were as good or better than most of the other sites. And by the dollar, we operate on a fraction of the budget of the NAV Center, and our rates are, I'm sure, as good as theirs of success, even without meaningful casework.
Now, Licton Springs has been controversial from the get-go because it allows people staying there to drink and use drugs on site. It's been open about a year and a half along Aurora Avenue, and it quickly created an outcry about increased crime in the area that many blamed on the villagers and their drug use. Johnson insists that that is not true, and he says Share and the village are wrongly being labeled a failed experiment. Now, on the flip side, LIHI tells the Seattle Times Share's early exit is good news, accusing Share leadership of often getting in the way of moving people into housing or even discouraging them from doing so in some cases. The city, meantime, just standing by its decision and says LIHI is ready to take over full operations now that Share is ending its agreement early.
So why would Share not want the members of the village to get into real housing?
You know, Share's position, the Charles Johnson, who I talked to, is that, like you kind of heard him say there in this cut, that it takes a long time to build this trust with people. Because what we're talking about, people in this particular village are chronically homeless with severe mental health issues or substance abuse issues that have been out on the street. They're the least likely to be willing to go in.
These are people who used to be sleeping in doorways or under bridges.
Yeah, absolutely. So he says it takes a long time to build up that trust with these people and get them to talk to you. And then he claims that they never had the case management and things of that nature that they were promised when they started this deal with the city, which was under former Mayor Ed Murray. You know, Mayor Jenny Durkin is coming in now. She's kind of putting her own mark on how she wants to proceed in dealing with the homeless crisis. My sense is, I haven't had anyone say this to me directly, is that they just don't feel like this particular model works. So we're going more to these enhanced shelters where you don't get to use drugs and drink when you're there.
Right. I get that. But I mean, is there any objective assessment of whether this village was causing a problem?
No. There are crime stats that can't be directly tied to it.
Who are living in middle-class housing who are drinking and shooting up on drugs. They just, you know, they live in middle-class housing, so no one notices them. And it doesn't bother me so much that people have bad habits, because a lot of people do. What would bother me is if these stories about, car prowls and break-ins are true. Do we know if they are true or not?
I know that there was an increase in crime in that area, but you cannot directly link it to this village. It's, as he said, Charles Johnson said, this is Aurora. It's a part of North Seattle on Aurora that has been a problem for years and years. So that's his position. I don't think there were police reports that show that an increase in crime, but then they kind of backtracked on that. And there's really no way to say that it's because of the village, is my point.
Now, Share Wheel is two of the oldest homeless organizations in Seattle. Now, is the city canceling their contract entirely or just for this place?
This for this place, but they run Tent City 3 and Tent City 5, and I'm not sure that that's contracted with the city. So this is the end of their involvement in any of the tiny house villages, that much I know for sure. And they had reached out sometime back suggesting that they were losing all funding from the city. So I'd have to look in for this.
So then what happens to these people?
The people at the village?
Yeah.
They're Lehigh, the low-income housing institute, is taking it over for the next 5 months. And then the city will work with them to get them into some of these enhanced shelters. And they say they're going to do everything they can do to get them into these other shelter models that their city is leaning more towards using at this point.
Well, that will be interesting to see if their record on getting permanent housing for these villagers, the very same people, is any better than Share Wheel's record.
Absolutely. Yeah, something to look for.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Last week, we got a new climate report from the United Nations warning that we have like around 10 years to do something serious about the carbon dioxide before there's a tipping point. And one of the things at stake, of course, is the fish supply in this area. That came to the fore when we started seeing the orcas disappear. But I thought I'd talk with somebody whose job it is to make sure the fish don't go away. He's Brad Warren, Executive Director of the National Fisheries Conservation Center. So you're one of those nonprofits. You're a do-good organization. First of all, you tell me, when I read a climate report saying we've got 10 years to go, are we talking about catastrophe here, or is it something we could live with?
Well, in the big picture, I think a lot of people won't live with it. If we allow this course to continue unchanged, there will not be as many people.
Not as many people.
Right. We will become self-limiting faster than we wish.
Because of food supplies or what?
Food supply, water supply. Those are two big ones.
I'm trying to get a feel because when people hear this issue discussed, they think it's being driven by liberal tree huggers who are just trying to scare us. After having talked to you, I think it's fair to say that you obviously care about the fish, but you had some issues with the liberals who started to try to campaign for climate change. Tell me about that.
Well, I come from the seafood industry side of this. I worked for 25 years in the seafood industry. I ran fishing industry trade publications. I worked as a fisherman. My perspective is that there are people who live outside of the world of the urban progressives. And even though the progressives have done a good job defining some of the right parts of the toolkit that need to be brought here, they didn't design the original version of this to work for people they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Like the fishermen.
Like fishermen, like truckers, like farmers, like loggers. There are a whole lot of people who produce and haul heavy things. And that work can't be done with a bus pass, and it can't be done with a Tesla. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we worked for...
We're talking about now the carbon tax initiative, 1631. First of all, do you think this is a good idea?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. It's got the right bones and it needed some improvements. We negotiated to get those improvements. We got them. And we think it's a pretty good deal for the working waterfront, for working lands, working waters, for the people who depend on them, for people who have to haul things, because they get the help they need.
There are predictions, though, that this could raise the price of gas by 50 cents a gallon, for starters.
Well, it's 15 cents to start, and in 15 years, if this thing is on track to hit the targets, which we think it will be based on the modeling work, then the price stops rising. And there's good reason to think that can occur, because there are policies elsewhere that are getting the job done cheap, and there's no reason we can't do it here.
Washington's just one little state, though. Will making Washington drivers and truckers and farmers more efficient really do enough to save the fish that you're trying to save?
Not by itself, but right now there are dozens of nations that have done this and states that have done it. There are 10 U.S. states that have already got policies like this. Mm. We're not going out on point. We're joining people who form a network of countries and states working together to fix a problem that we worked together to create. From Maine to Maryland, a program that prices emissions at a very modest price from their coal-fired power plants and uses the money to increase fuel efficiency and make more clean energy. They have reduced emissions by more than 50% in 9 years. They have generated tens of thousands of jobs. They've added billions of dollars to their GDP. And in the last 3 years, they avoided buying close to $1 billion worth of fossil fuels in the region because they don't need to. They're getting all their work done. They're growing their economy. They're growing jobs. And they're not spending as much money on fuel because they don't need it.
That's probably why the oil companies might have a few things to say about this.
I would think so. It's a problem we all are affected by. And everyone has a stake in a solution. And when we get the solutions right, we actually spend less money on energy. That's the lesson from the East Coast.
Oceans have been changing, over the eons. At some point, don't species, that's the way the world works. Temperatures change, species migrate or they adapt. How do we know that if the ocean changes by 4 degrees, whatever it is, a new and maybe even more delicious species will populate our waters?
As it becomes warmer and more acidic, the ocean is developing plankton that are toxic, that cause shutdowns of shellfish harvest throughout the Northwest. In 2015, we had a coastwide shutdown of the Dungeness crab fishery from California to Washington for the heart of the season, and people took a beating. Out on the Washington coast, the razor clam fishery was shut down because it was toxic to eat. You can have an ocean that becomes no longer capable of making dinner.
Which would do what?
Well, billions of people get dinner from it. Hundreds of millions of people make a living producing that dinner. In Washington state alone, I just looked it up today, there are 61,000 jobs supported by seafood. That's what we have at stake.
So this is not a hoax?
Far from it. If it were, it would be good news. And my friends who ardently wish this to be false, I basically tell them, good luck, keep going. I hope you win that. I'll go do something easier.
Brad Warren is the executive director of the National Fisheries Conservation Center. Brad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is from 710 ESPN, that pyroclastic flow of sports, Danny O'Neill, and the big game. The big...
Wait, Danny's looking at you like, what did you just say
about
me?
What does pyroclastic mean?
It's, that's what happens after a big eruption.
Yeah. Magma being released.
Pyroclastic.
Yes.
It's familiar of pyrotechnic.
No. Pyroclastic.
Similar root word from the Greek.
Yeah.
Would you say that his is more of an explosive flow or more of
Depends
like
on the day.
Yeah, you're right.
If he's buying like a goat, I would say that it was explosive.
It's more magma than ash. So, you're in there. You're fiery with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, ESPN Game Day is coming to Pullman for the first time. And there's been a Wazoo photo bombing campaign on ESPN to get this day to happen.
Well, they kept sending their flag to make sure it appeared at all game day sites. They've been doing this for 15 years, where ESPN goes around the country, and each week they'll set up shop, set up their studio. They'll have a live show from the campus of the game that they're featuring that week, and they've never gone to Wazoo, but each and every episode has featured the Ole Crimson, as they call it. Is that right? Yeah, Ole Crimson flying in the background, which I think is amazing that the Cougs have been able to coordinate that.
They are nothing if not persistent with that flag. I mean, I've seen pictures all over the world at the top of Mount Everest. I think I saw a picture of the flag up there. It's a thing.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say they are nothing if not persistent. They might not be good enough to host College Game Day, but gosh darn it, they'll get their laundry flag in the background.
Well, why did Game Day pass on Wazoo for so long?
Have you ever been to Pullman?
Well, sure. I lived in Spokane 5 years, covered plenty of stories.
Can you imagine the logistics of trying to, like, hey, let's take this whole thing on down to Pullman.
But you'd think as a television show that they would want the enthusiasm of that fan base. That makes an exciting show. Forget logistics. They got money.
Now I've got to ask if you're familiar with Paul Wolf when he was the Washington State coach. Because there's been an extended period where they were terrible.
Oh.
Absolutely awful. It's kind of why I root for them sometimes, because you feel bad for the little suckers. But they're pretty good now. And they're ranked. And they got Mike Leach as their coach. Yep. And they've returned to prominence. And gosh darn it, Game Day's going there.
Good. Maybe I them. Shouldn't be so surprised, though, because ESPN commentators still call it Gonzaga.
That's true. They
I
will
just
do
think
that.
They have no memory for the eastern side of Washington
State. As someone who's known to butcher a word from time to time,
but Gonzaga,
I ought not cast stones.
Who's been in the big dance for years and years and years, they still call it Gonzaga.
I love that.
So I hope that they...
That they mispronounce their name. I love the disrespect.
And, strangely, the Cougs are actually playing for the Huskies.
Yes, they are.
Aren't they?
That's correct. They don't want to hear it, but it is absolutely true.
So explain that to everybody.
So Washington lost to Oregon last week, which you heard.
Yeah.
You remember that?
I remember that, yeah.
Washington lost to Oregon, but if the Cougs beat Oregon, Washington will once again have control of its own destiny, and you know what that means, Dave.
That means their wild card magic number is 6?
Incorrect. It means that if they win the rest of their games, they will be the Pac-12 North champions. Kings of the North! We may not have a national playoff, but we could still be Kings of the North, so go Cougs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Everybody needs a reason to cheer. I'm not sure if that's very persuasive for a lot of people, but that'll do. And what is your prediction for this game?
My prediction is going to be Oregon 31, Wazoo 28.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Did you get the last game right?
Did I get it right?
Yeah.
You mean
the Oregon Husky game?
No, Dave, I did not
get
it right.
Well, I'm not going to believe this time.
We can recall that audio. What happens? I've never watched a game day. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. Seriously?
You're surprised?
Yes.
they have Kirk Herbstreit, Reese Davis, Lee Corso, who is, I think at this point, 84 years old. He's a former head coach. Kirk Herbstreit is the most handsome man in television, former Ohio State coach. They get up and they talk about all the games, and in the background, lunatics make signs.
So that's the big deal.
That will say these things.
It's TV, Colleen.
All right.
It's TV.
TV lost its shine for me after reporting in Spokane for 5 years.
There's a bunch of people that are really excited about it.
Okay.
And it's gathering in the background, and then when they come time to pick the winner of the game where they're at, Lee Corso will put on the head of the mascot, which he picks.
Ooh.
So last week he picked Bucky Badger. They were in Ann Arbor, and he puts on the big stuffed head.
Cool.
Yeah.
You sound unconvinced.
I can see why it's a big deal.
Okay, let me put it to you this way. I went to one of the first ones when they had it in Eugene a million years ago against UCLA, back before it was a thing. We just wandered out onto the practice field at like 6:30 in the morning. There were like 50 people there, and my brother and I each had a 12-pack of beer, and that was 6:30 in the morning. And the show went till 9, and then now it's 2,000 people. It's just become this thing, and it's pretty fun. As a matter of fact, I talked to a neighbor whose son is a freshman at Wazoo. They're already planning on how they're going to pre-funk. Unfortunately, the game is at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so they'll go to game day. Sleep, sober up a little bit, and then go back and then ready for the game.
Glad sober up
just
is
a little
the timeline.
Bit. Just a little bit.
Take the edge off.
Yeah, Pullman's going to be crazy for this.
Really, I can't imagine. Well, thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
You have heard her battle cry, or at least part of her battle cry.
All I could think was, not today.
That's Kelly Herron, who took down a would-be rapist in Golden Gardens Park last year. And it says she again had to fight off an attack while she was out running.
He knew me. He had this really creepy smile on his face, and he just ran right at me and grabbed my rear end.
I spoke to Kelly yesterday about the attack Sunday. She has moved from Seattle to Vancouver, Washington, for reasons we can talk about later. And she was running in a small race Sunday. On her last mile, she'd become separated from the rest of the pack at that point, was alone rounding a corner when she saw the man.
So I came around the corner, and he kind of came towards me. And his hands were down low, kind of like a low hug position. And he just ran right at me and grabbed my rear end full on. And I turned and I looked at him, and he got this smug smile across his face. And it just sent me into a complete rage. But I just spun around on my heels, started chasing him, and I just screamed, "Assault! Assault! Assault!" And the only place he had to go was back into the race course.
She chased after him, but he was able to run faster than her at that point. But luckily, a good Samaritan stepped in.
A spectator, like maybe a tenth of a mile down, there was a guy on a bench with his wife, and he stood up and he's like, "What happened?" And I said, "That guy grabbed my, I don't know if you can say it, and he knocked him down." And they were kind of wrestling, and I thought the guy got away. I wasn't sure, but I also was running a race. I wasn't just out for an afternoon jog. Like, I had something really important going on, and it was a weird kind of decision to make, but I just ran to the finish.
She finished her half marathon anyway. By that time, she had learned the man who helped her had called police, and they cuffed the guy. Kelly has given her account of the groping to police. The man was booked Sunday for assault, is awaiting charges now. Charges Kelly absolutely intends to pursue, even if it means another long, painful process of confronting her attacker.
This is not stopping me. I'll be out running today and again tomorrow and almost every day. So, and there was a moment when I turned around, it was almost like I had this decision to make. Do I let it go or do I pursue? And I can't be public about saying, fight back, see something, say something. You know, all my message is about that. And I just hope that this inspires other women to do the same thing, even though it is emotionally exhausting and frustrating and irritating and inconvenient. I think this is the only way, is we have to stop these guys. We have to press charges. We have to file reports. We have to just not stand for it or let it go or let it slide anymore.
And so we're waiting to get, you know, the full picture of this guy. Does he have past priors? Is this a pattern of behavior that he might have been escalating?
So has this happened on races on a regular basis?
I don't know about races, but I do know it happens to women on a regular basis.
I know that,
on buses, I mean, in public, in crowded spaces, at parks. There was just a runner attacked in Seattle last month who was thinking of Kelly Herron when she fought off her attacker. So this cycle continues, and that's why Kelly is going to pursue charges, even though she continues to suffer this day from PTSD and hypervigilance from the brutal attack in the Golden Gardens bathroom. You remember the pictures of her. She was bruised up. He was bruised up. She really fought.
But another thing, you have to have security at these races, too, right? Because, actually, a guy's probably figuring, okay, I'll wait till like halfway through the race when they're tired, and then I'll do this, and they won't be able to catch me.
Yeah.
And so...
And when people think of races,
if it had not been
for
that other person who happened to witness it, he'd have gotten away.
Right. Well, didn't witness it, but was down the line because she ran out after and heard her. So, you know, this is in Vancouver. It was not the Boston Marathon. We're not talking about races where people line the course the entire way. There are portions when you're going to be alone, especially near the end of the race when faster runners and slower runners get separated. So is it feasible to have security at every turn and in every tree line or bush? Probably not. What happened to
Gary Steiner, the guy who assaulted her in the restroom?
Yeah, Gary Steiner, he was a transient sex offender from Arizona who failed to register here, hid in the bathroom, waited for his victim, attempted to rape her in the bathroom. Again, she fought him off. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but he died in prison shortly after sentencing. And Kelly was fine with that. She said, it's one less day I have to worry about continuing to testify against him.
Yeah. Wow. So we don't know about this latest guy. He'll be in jail. She's going to go back and testify. But now you're saying the guy who chased her down was not a witness. So does that make this her word against his? Is that what this boils down to?
It depends on the prosecutor. It depends on if this guy has priors. As we know about these creeps, typically it's a pattern of behavior. They start with groping, then they go towards more bold groping, possibly rape. So we don't know much about this guy. If this was his first offense or more, I suppose that will influence the prosecution.
Yeah. All right. We'll see what happens.
Can I share a little tip?
Yeah, please.
Because I've learned a lot from Kelly in following her story for the last, what has it been, almost a year and a half now. And we've become close in talking woman to woman about these sort of things. And I go running. I go running in the evening. That's the only time I have time. So what she suggested is this ring she wears now. It's called a Go Guarded. It's a knife that you wear on your finger. It's a hard plastic. It's covered by silicone. Really easy. I don't feel like I could hurt myself with it, but I do feel like I could hurt someone else if anybody tried anything. It's just that one piece of assurance that you have that if somebody were to grab you, you could quickly swipe at their face and do some pretty good damage. It's $10.
Yes. What does it look like?
Well, I have a picture of it on my Twitter page if you want to see it, but it's a small serrated knife about the size of one of my knuckles to another one of my knuckles.
Yeah. I'm thinking, you know, if it looks like a common enough ring, then anytime you see somebody with a ring, it might
scare the guy off. A common enough ring.
It
looks like, you know, I often hold it up so it's visible while I'm running, especially in close
places. So that's
the
idea. It's a deterrent.
Yeah, don't even approach me.
Yeah.
I will slice your face. Yeah.
Well, that
it's either that or become a victim of rape, right? I mean, we're talking serious occurrences here, and it happens a lot to women everywhere, so might as well protect yourself.
Choke points brought to you by Online Trading Academy. We're getting a new ferry terminal downtown, but it's going to take a while. And in the meantime, lots of things are being moved around. Lots of pieces being moved around the board. And Chris has all the details of this latest move.
Yeah, I believe it's going to be 2023 before the dock is done there at Coleman Dock, before all the repairs and the retrofitting. And so, yeah, it's been quite a dance because they're trying to keep Coleman Dock operating. I mean, they have to keep the ferries going between Bainbridge and Bremerton. But they, in order to work on it while keeping it open, I mean, they're moving the parking, they're moving the entrances, they're moving whatever. And so that's going to continue this weekend. The ferry system, Brock Bender, says this weekend's going to be a little out of the norm in terms of the disruption.
We are closing down the north half of Coleman Dock for construction all weekend long.
That means drivers are going to be squeezed onto the south side of the dock for the entire 2 days.
All waiting vehicles for the ferry will wait on the south dock, so the dock will be at half capacity with overflow at Pier 48, which is our overflow vehicle holding lane just south of the dock.
But it's not just the parking and the waiting that is going to be impacted. The dock itself is operating at half capacity this weekend.
We're going to be operating out of just one slip. So one slip will be closed, one slip will be open. All arrivals and departures coming in and out of Seattle from Bainbridge and Bremerton will share that single slip.
So that means only one boat in there at a time. The captains have been told to kind of slow things down to obviously allow for the offloading and whatnot and to give them plenty of room to maneuver around there. It's going to throw off all the schedule for the trips between Seattle and Bremerton and Seattle and Bainbridge. They're going to be working on a modified weekend schedule.
We have a temporary weekend schedule. It's really important that folks check the schedule before you roll out. It's on our website. The sailings will be about 5 to 30 minutes different than they are in the regular schedule.
The dock is in the middle of a 6-year facelift, as we mentioned. Many of the wood pilings that hold it up are 70 years old or in bad shape. Some of them have been eaten away entirely. So you have the top kind of hanging down from the dock and then the bottom kind of coming up from the bottom, but there's nothing in between.
That's bad.
Yeah, a little bit more than duct tape would take to fix here. And again, the whole dock itself is not designed to handle a significant earthquake. And so this weekend, they're going to get to work on some of those pilings.
It allows us to get a head start on the next phase of work, which is pile pulling and pile driving. So that work is happening in November. The work that we'll be doing this weekend will build a platform to allow for a crane that will help with that work.
So if you're going to be using a ferry this weekend through Coleman Dock, whether you're going to Bremerton or Bainbridge or back and forth, Brock says that you should add about 30 minutes to your arrival time just to make sure. So in other words, if you normally show up 45 minutes before your boat, you should add 30 to that just to make sure that you can get around the odd parking situation, and if they have to use overflow to get you into and through, and so, and also because the boats are going to kind of be jockeying through that one slip situation.
Yeah. I don't know how much you know about this, but are they going to replace the wooden pilings with new wooden pilings or put in concrete ones?
It's a new earthquake friendly, you know, to handle you know, the, and as we found out through Bertha's digging there, that part of Elliott Bay is not exactly, you know, the best cure for stability. So they're going to be working hard there to replace those with a better earthquake safe foundation.
You know, it occurs to me, we have two floating bridges. Why couldn't you build the new terminal someplace and then just float it into place overnight and you'd have a new terminal?
That would be fabulous. I think that would be a great idea. However, they decided to go with this. Probably, but the one thing that they are doing is the reason why they're doing this in such a dramatic way is because they're looking at Coleman Dock as the one way to maybe get in and out of Seattle should we have a catastrophic event that should perhaps, say, damage the ship canal or damage all of the I-5 system. They see that as a way of getting goods and services in and out. That's why they're retrofitting the island sides as well, the Bremertons and Bainbridge, so as a way to get a mass amount of people or supplies in and out should we get one of those super biggies, which would maybe knock I-5 out. So they're really starting to look at that as a way of moving us should we have a big one.
They also reinforced the Vashon slips with these huge concrete reinforcing pilings there too.
Yeah. I mean, it's all part of the process of using the ferry system as a way to deliver goods and people should we lose our primary freeways or roads and bridges through a significant event. So they're starting to think about that as they do that. So
makes sense.